Welcome to the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use, and I suggest you have a pencil and paper handy just in case there's something you want to write down. Here in local news, it's been revealed that sea lions who washed up on the beach in Malibu had died of gunshot wounds in this story by Scott Kaufman of The Raw Story. Wildlife rescuers say that at least three sea lions who were washed ashore in Malibu, California, died of gunshot wounds. Jonesy Ross with the California Wildlife Center told CBS News that this happens because squid fishermen shine light on the surface of the water, which also attracts sea lions. The other thing is that squid season just opened. A Malibu resident reported on Wednesday that she started hearing the gunshots, and they weren't M80s, they weren't flash bombs, they were rifles. Fishermen are allowed to use non-lethal methods to scare sea lions away, but they're not supposed to kill them because they're protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. However, a representative for the squid fishermen, Diane Pleschner-Steele, director of the California Wetfish Producers Association, told CBS News that none of the fishermen she knew to be in the Malibu area were aware of the shooting. There is a live California condor webcam just started up in Big Sur. In this story by Paul Rogers of the San Jose Mercury News, for years it's been a rare experience to see an endangered California condor in the wild. There are only 429 of North America's largest bird alive today, and half of them live in zoos, but this past Monday, with some high-tech help, the bird watching got a lot easier. The first camera to capture live streaming video of condors in the wild was turned on in the remote hills back of Big Sur. The solar-powered condor cam allows the public to watch the huge vulture-like birds feeding, grooming, and flying in real time, and enables scientists to monitor them more efficiently. We put the camera right on top of one of the main feeding areas so that we could zoom down and get identification of each individual, said Kelly Sorensen, executive director of the Ventana Wildlife Society, a nonprofit that has worked to bring condors back from the brink of extinction. Over the weekend when we were testing it, we had 25 condors in front of the camera. If you want to watch the condors, go to the Condor Cam website, www.ventanaws.org. That's VENTANAWS.org. Several times a week, biologists who work with the organization pull out stillborn calves on the site, a 240-acre property surrounded by wilderness in the Los Padres National Forest of Monterey County. Several condors were seen Monday morning on the live camera, eating and preening. Biologists from the group will zoom in on the birds at key times, such as in the morning when they are most active, Sorensen said. They also plan to ask the public to send notifications on the Ventana Wildlife Society's Facebook and Twitter feeds when the birds are doing something interesting, just in case they aren't watching. It wasn't easy setting up the camera. The area is so rural that there is no electricity or internet connections available. The system, which cost about $15,000, Sorensen said, was funded by a donation from FedEx and help from the Oakland Zoo. Crews installed a high-speed T1 internet connection at a home 12 miles north of the site. Then they set up antennas to get the signal to the solar-powered camera. On Wednesday at noon, biologists will be releasing three condors on camera that were raised in captivity. I guess that happened yesterday. When they aren't releasing birds, the new video footage can help scientists see how condors are feeding or whether they're exhibiting signs of lead poisoning from eating dead animals with lead bullet fragments in them. We have to drive 1.5 hours up a dirt road behind 5 lock gates just to get to this place, Sorensen said. It's an all-day thing, so this is an amazing tool to help us monitor condors in the wild. Wild animals, including condors, don't always do cute and cuddly things, however. In fact, the Ventana Wildlife Society website has a note saying, "Viewer discretion advised, may contain graphic feeding images." So if you want to see condors ripping apart dead calves, that website again, www.ventanaws.org. Coming up is a Santa Cruz Puma Project presentation. And this will be happening Wednesday, December 4th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Loudon Nelson Center Auditorium. We'll be repeating this announcement as we get closer to the date. It's almost a month away, month and a bit away. Join us for a presentation of the Santa Cruz Puma Project. Wildlife ecologist Chris Wilmers will discuss his study of mountain lion habitat fragmentation in the Santa Cruz Mountains, including the process of applying GPS tag collars, information on where those lions are going, and the effects of roads and houses on mountain lions. If you want more information on the study, go to santacruzpumas.org. That's santacruzpumas.org. If you'd like to go to the event, you need to register at scpumaprojectpresentation.eventbrite.com. I know that's a long one, but that's why I asked you to get a pencil out. It's scpumaprojectpresentation.eventbrite.com, and you can register for free tickets at that site, and we'll get back to that announcement later on. Moving to some news of the weird and weirder. U.S. scout leaders have toppled an ancient rock formation and triggered outrage in this story by Dan Whitcomb, with editing by Cynthia Johnson and Guna Dixon of World Environment News Thomson Reuters. An online video of two Boy Scout of America leaders knocking over a 170-million-year-old rock formation in the Utah State Park has touched off worldwide outrage, state officials said. And the two men may face charges. The video was posted on YouTube showing scout leader Glenn Taylor dislodging the massive rock free from its tiny perch in Goblin Valley State Park as Dave Hall films him while singing and laughing. We have now modified Goblin Valley, Hall shouts into the camera. A new Goblin Valley exists with this boulder down here at the bottom. The rock formation, known as a goblin, dates to the late Jurassic era and is one of many that give the desert park a surreal appearance that draws visitors from around the world. These goblins are basically rocks set atop a very thin column of sandstone. The video has been viewed more than 1.4 million times since it was uploaded to YouTube by the Salt Lake Tribune newspaper last week. Fred Hayes, Utah State Parks director, said his office has been inundated with angry calls and emails from literally around the world, Hayes said. Folks who have either been there to Goblin Valley State Park or who have even just seen pictures of it. The southwestern desert has a lot of appeal for people and they are just outraged. Hayes said authorities first became aware of the video when a visitor posted a link to it on the state park's website, asking if such activity were legal. Well, it ain't. Prosecutors in Emory County will determine if charges will be filed, he said. The two scout leaders told the Deseret News newspaper that they toppled the boulder because they thought it posed a danger to children who might be walking by, an explanation that the state parks director greeted with some skepticism. Neither one of us were out there intending to do illegal activity, Hall said. It just made sense to us at the time, removing the danger so that we wouldn't have to hear about somebody dying. State Parks Director Hayes said park rangers walk through the valley daily and had never considered the boulders to be a danger, noting that it took considerable effort for Taylor to shove it over. A Boy Scouts of America spokesman said the organization also reviewed the matter and announced later that the two had been removed as Boy Scout leaders. We are shocked and disappointed by this reprehensible behavior. For more than a century, the Boy Scouts of America has been a leader in conservation from stewardship to sustainability, Boy Scout spokesman Darren Smith said. The isolated actions of these individuals are absolutely counter to our beliefs and what we teach. He said, no word about whether the boulder is going to be stuck back up on the pillar, however. And moving to protests from a long way away. Remove your machinery within 3 days, Baram natives warn Sarawak Energy. Native communities from Malaysia's remote Baram district on the island of Borneo, Malaysia, have warned state-owned electricity provider Sarawak Energy today to remove its construction machinery from their lands within 3 days. The machinery had been transported to the Baram region in order to prepare for the construction of a 1,200-megawatt dam, the water behind which would displace 20,000 natives and flood a rainforest area of 400 square kilometers. According to Sarawak's Save Rivers Network, a group of 30 workers were about to conduct rock testing activities at the planned dam site at Long Na. The workers were told to pack up and leave the native lands immediately. The workers tried to negotiate, but were told in no uncertain terms that there was no need for further negotiations, as the native communities had rejected the dam project. Sarawak Energy was given a 3-day ultimatum to remove its machinery from native lands. A group of villagers set up a camp at the planned dam site to monitor implementation of their demands. Villagers holding a second roadblock site near Long Lama said that their blockade was also successful and no new construction equipment had been transported into the interior. And we got this news story, and you can read further about it at www.intercontinentalcry.org. That's intercontinentalcry.org. And Russia has refused law of the sea arbitration in the seizure of the Greenpeace Arctic vessel. However, charges have been reduced to hooliganism in this story from the Environment News Service. Russia will not accept an international arbitration process under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, at which the Netherlands is seeking the release of the Dutch-flagged Greenpeace ship Arctic Sunrise and its crew. The Russian Foreign Ministry says it will not attend the hearing at the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea. At that hearing, the Netherlands will ask the tribunal to direct Russia to release the Arctic Sunrise and its crew and allow them to leave Russian territory. Activists of the Greenpeace actions in relation to the platform Pyrazlomnaya, I guess that's how it's pronounced, on the 18th of September, violated Russian law on the economic exclusion zone and the continental shelf. A criminal investigation into the incident is ongoing, the Russian Foreign Ministry said in a statement on Wednesday. Yet the ministry did say that Russia remains open to resolving the situation. The ministry also announced that charges against the 30 prisoners will be reduced to hooliganism, with a maximum penalty of 7 years in prison instead of the 15 years they face if they were convicted of piracy. The Netherlands claims that the arrest and detention of the Arctic Sunrise and its crew in September during a protest action off of Russia's northern coast took place in violation of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. On September 18th, Greenpeacers used ropes in an attempt to board the Pyrazlomnaya in protest against oil drilling in the Barents Sea. Russian law enforcement authorities arrested two activists at the scene. But the next day, the Arctic Sunrise was boarded by Coast Guard officials, brought to the port of Murmansk, and detained. 30 members of the crew and journalists, nationals of Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Canada, Denmark, Finland, France, Italy, Morocco, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Poland, Russia, Sweden, Switzerland, Turkey, Ukraine, the United Kingdom, and the United States, were arrested and detained in Murmansk. The Arctic 30, as Greenpeace has dubbed them, are being held in a Murmansk prison on charges first of piracy and now of hooliganism, and have all been refused bail. Greenpeace says 30 people are behind bars in Russia following a peaceful protest against oil drilling in the Arctic They took action because they know it is wrong to exploit melting ice to drill for more of the oil that is warming our world. They were first charged with piracy, an absurd accusation. Now Russian authorities say that accusation is being replaced with a charge of hooliganism, a charge that is also as absurd and carries up to 7 years in jail. Vladimir Chuprov of Greenpeace Russia said, "We will contest the trumped-up charge of hooliganism as strongly as we contested the piracy allegations. They are both fantasy charges that bear no relation to reality. The Arctic 30 protested peacefully against Gazprom's dangerous oil drilling and should be freed." The International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea is an independent judicial body located in Hamburg, Germany, established to resolve disputes about the interpretation and application of the United States Convention on the Law of the Sea. The Dutch authorities initiated an arbitration case against Russia on October 4th, and on October 21st called for the International Tribunal to indicate provisional measures pending the outcomes of that arbitration. If the tribunal rules in favor of the Netherlands, the 28 Greenpeace International activists and freelance photographers Dennis Sinkyakov and freelance videographer Kieran Byron could go free while they wait confirmation of a Russian court date. And here we have another essay by George Werther entitled "A New Paradigm for Forests That Embraces Wildlife and Beetles." We need a new paradigm for our forests and natural ecology agents like wildfire, beetles, and other factors that influence forest ecosystems. Unfortunately, far too many forest managers still display a lack of ecological understanding and a hostile attitude towards natural forest processes like beetle kills and wildfire. Dead trees do not indicate an unhealthy forest. Indeed, dead trees are critical to future forest ecosystems and a sign that our forests are actually ecologically healthy because the natural ecological processes that work to maintain forest integrity like beetles and wildfire are intact. What we see today is an expansion of the acreage of trees killed either by pine beetles or by wildfire. Both of these factors are native components of our forest ecosystems and a natural response to changing climatic conditions. Indeed, our forests are adapted to them. They are compensatory sources of mortality that bring forests back into alignment with the available moisture, nutrients, and other limiting resources. These changes in forest response are at least partially symptomatic of human-caused climatic change. In other words, we are treating the symptoms instead of treating the ultimate cause of these changes. That the acreage affected is larger than in the recent past does not necessarily mean that our forests are unnatural, out of balance, or, dare I use the term, sick. These ecological processes can be thought of like wolves to a deer herd. They are thinning our forests, bringing them into balance with the available nutrients, moisture, and space now dictated by a warming climate. Bear in mind that we don't have to spend money to fight fires or beetle outbreaks. That is a mistaken effort to thwart natural thinning processes. These ecological processes are restoring our forests and doing the restoration at absolutely no cost to taxpayers. It's important to point out that even in the more severe beetle events, many trees survive to go on to form the next generation of forest. And even though the acreage of forest burns has expanded, the percent of stand replacement blazes is still small. For instance, one recent analysis of the 2012 fires in Idaho that charred 1.7 million acres of the state's forests found only 13% of the tree-covered lands was severely burned. The vast majority of acreage burns were classified as low severity. Indeed, there are some ecologists who insist we do not have enough large stand replacement blazes or what are called severe fires. The snag forests that result from such fires are temporarily rare and spatially infrequent and critical to many wildlife species. We may need more of them. We have seen these kinds of episodic natural forest thinning events in the past. If you review paleoecology of forests in the Rockies, there are many examples of warmer climatic periods when conditions were as warm as or even warmer than at present. It was during the medieval warm spell when the Anasazi Indians abandoned their pueblos in the southwest due to massive drought, and the Vikings were able to colonize Greenland due to high Arctic warming. During this warm spell, huge wildfires and beetle expansion occurred throughout the West. And contrary to popular myth that ponderosa pine never experienced stand replacement burns, during this warm period, even low-elevation ponderosa pine forests experienced significant stand replacement blazes. The forests of this period were restored by these natural thinning agents to the carrying capacity dictated by the new climatic conditions. Since that time, cooler, moister climatic conditions combined with forest mismanagement, logging of large fire-resistant trees, overgrazing of vegetation, fire suppression, forest fragmentation, etc., have allowed forest densities to increase. Despite these human-caused issues, the forests are perfectly capable of restoration without more human interference. Our forests are now responding to human-caused climatic change, which is creating warmer, drier conditions. These conditions are promoting expansion of natural thinning agents like beetles and wildfires. However, instead of viewing these as negative factors that we must save the forest from, we should see them as critical to forest ecosystem integrity. Fires and beetles are far superior at restoring forests than foresters and loggers. They, like wolves do to deer, pick the most vulnerable individuals and remove them from the population. The end result is a stronger, healthier forest, or deer herd. Furthermore, logging is not benign. Logging creates unhealthy forests. It is virtually impossible to log without creating significant ecological impacts. For one thing, logging removes biomass, the live and dead trees that are a biological legacy or biological capital that is invested in the next generation of forests. Dead trees are also important for many wildlife species, with one estimate suggesting that two-thirds of all vertebrate wildlife species rely upon dead trees and down wood at some point in their lives. Dead trees are also critical to aquatic ecosystems, providing both structures to streams as well as to nutrients. Suggesting that we need to log our forests to fix them is both self-serving to the timber industry as well as the federal land management agencies whose budgets depend on getting the cut out. Be wary of any prescriptions that suggest we need to log our forests to restore them. What we need to do is leave our forests alone to self-restore and self-regenerate themselves. To make human communities comfortable with such a prescription, the Forest Service should emphasize reducing the flammability of homes, the removal of flammable materials, including trees near homes, and not building homes in forested areas. When I see the dead trees from beetle kills or wildfires, I'm thankful that our forests are still healthy and actively being restored by natural processes. It's time for our federal agencies to adopt a similar viewpoint. And this has been an essay by George Werthner entitled A New Paradigm for Forests That Embraces Wildfire and Beetles. And we have a little bit of time here for some biodiversity news. Two plants and three species that fly have been proposed for protection. The Florida bricklebush, a 3-foot-tall white-flowered aster, and Carter's small-flowered flax, a foot-tall yellow-flowered plant, both survive only in Florida's Miami-Dade County and are threatened by habitat destruction and invasive species, earning them both proposed protection with 2,707 acres of critical habitat. Those Florida flowers aren't the only ones to be newly proposed for protection under our 757 species agreement. Three creatures of the sky, two birds and one mammal, were also proposed. The yellow-billed cuckoo, a striking songbird also known as the rain crow for its habit of singing right before storms, was once found along nearly every waterway in the West, but dams, livestock grazing, and other forces reduced it only to a handful of locations in the Southwest. The center first petitioned for its protection in 1998, and it has finally won a proposal. The red knot, a rust-bellied shorebird that migrates 9,300 miles between the poles, was also proposed for protection. The knot has sharply declined in part because of the loss of an important prey item on its long journey, the horseshoe crabs of Delaware Bay, which are severely over-harvested and disappearing. And northern long-eared bats were proposed as well due to widespread mortality caused by the disease white nose syndrome over much of eastern North America. The Center for Biological Diversity and their allies petitioned for these bats in 2010. And habitat has been protected for rare Texas cave critters. The Center for Biological Diversity works to save all creatures, great and small, furry, scaled, tree nesting, and cave dwelling. This week we won a big victory for three on the small end, the Comal Springs Riffle Beetle, the Comal Springs Dryopid Beetle, and Peck's Cave Amphipod, a crustacean. After two lawsuits for these three invertebrates, which live only in four springs running through caves near Texas's Edwards Aquifer, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced on Tuesday it would designate protected critical habitat for them, overlapping areas amounting to 169 acres. All the species are most threatened by groundwater pumping and pollution of the precious aquifer that feeds their springs. These animals are all way too interesting to describe fully here. For instance, the riffle beetle sports a mass of tiny, unwettable hairs on its underside, which allow it to make a thin bubble of air, letting it breathe while it swims. And that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, normally broadcasting at 101.3 FM, and on our website, www.freakradio.org. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, and we want to thank you for listening. If you want to hear this program over again, tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, or you can tune in to Radio Free Moscow, KRFP Idaho, on Monday nights at 9:30 p.m. Their frequency is 92.5 FM. Once again, that's KRFP in Moscow, Idaho. If you'd like to download or listen to a podcast, please go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, for all, .net. We do want to thank you for listening.